All right. Do you have a binge
Yeah.
to tell our friends?
This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the podcast.
I'm Morgan.
And I'm Sarah.
And this week we are on episode 66, where we are covering the Cracker Barrel murders.
And it is when three Cracker Barrel employees in Naples, Florida, were murdered inside of the restaurant in 1995 in what police believed was a robbery gone wrong.
Yeah, so we're back in our home state today doing a little bit of Florida.
Yeah, and Naples is, what, only like an hour, maybe an hour and a half south of us.
Yeah, it's like pretty close, and I actually drove by Cracker Barrel today and was just like giving it a little wave as I drove past it. I was like, I'll be talking about you later. Not the Naples one specifically, but you know.
Yeah. And I had never heard about this, even though it was like so close to us.
Yeah, I hadn't heard about it. Why am I registering? Like, I'm peaking so much and I wasn't peaking this much last time. Sorry. I don't remember where I heard about these murders, because I think it was like through a podcast or a television show of some sort, mm-hmm. because I had never heard of them either and was like, oh, that happened in Florida? That's crazy.
Yeah. And like, I tried looking for like other podcasts who had done it and mm-hmm. stuff like that, and I could only find one.
Okay.
Which was Paradise After Dark.
Yeah.
And then like most of the research came from like the court documents, honestly. Yeah. So like, you had to dig in deep for this one.
Yeah, that's awesome. Look at us covering things that haven't been covered that much by the podcast yet.
I'm so proud of us.
Look at us go. but before we get into the crime today, what is your binge?
So this week, my binge is the podcast Counterclock.
Okay.
And it's part of like Ashley Flowers podcast network.
Yeah.
And it is hosted by Delia D'Ambra, who she also does Park Predators, and she's done a couple other things like with Ashley Flowers. And basically what the podcast is, there's two seasons, mm-hmm. and they both, basically she investigates like an unsolved, for season one, it's an unsolved crime in her hometown in North Carolina.
Okay.
And she goes and she talks to basically everyone that was involved, the police, their friends, people who they thought were there.
Mm-hmm.
So you get all these interviews, and like, she doesn't solve the crime, but at the end you're like, you know, this person did it.
Yeah.
And so then season two is about this woman who was murdered, and police locked up this guy,
mm-hmm.
and it's like the whole they blame the black guy thing.
Oh.
Because there wasn't evidence that, basically any physical evidence,
yeah.
that he was the murderer.
Mm-hmm.
But he was their scapegoat, and he spent 17 years in prison.
Oh, wow.
And then was released.
Yeah.
But he's still charged for that murder. And so they're trying to figure out, like, if they can get him acquitted and figure out who
yeah.
the real murderer is.
Good. Yeah, we need to, like, get the real people who did
yeah.
the crimes in jail, rather than like just because we want to get the crime finished and like we want to solve that case, so we're just gonna put whoever we want in jail.
Yeah. And it's, she is like calling out the police. She's like, you didn't interview these people or these
yeah.
people who were with her on the night she was murdered. Like, who the fuck are you?
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
That just sounds like shoddy police work. I don't know anything about it, but it just sounds not great.
Yeah, it's not. But it's really interesting. She goes really in depth with things, and like, you can go on their website, and since she actually goes to the town, like, you can see videos of her like introducing you where the person's house was and
mm-hmm.
what the street looked like and what, like, all
yeah.
this stuff. So
very
it's really
cool.
It's really fascinating.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's yeah. like female Payne Lindsay.
Exactly.
Yeah, awesome.
What is your binge this week, Morgan?
My binge this week is going to be The Haunting of Bly Manor.
Nice.
I won't talk too much about it because it literally came out 3 days ago by
yeah.
the time we're recording this. But Saturday, like, me and my roommates just plopped our asses down on the couch, watched the first 7 out of 9 episodes, nice. And then on Sunday finished up the last two.
Did you watch the first one? Was that Haunting on Hill Manor?
Yes, Haunting of Hill House. Okay, Hill so House. Basically the exact same name, but just slightly different. Okay. And it's, to me, it seems almost American Horror Story-esque, where it's like an anthology series because they use the majority of the same actors in The Haunting of Bly Manor, and they're just all new characters, but it's like a similar story because they're in a fucking haunted house, basically. Yeah. So yeah, it was really cool. At the beginning, I was like, ooh, is this spookier than the first season? And then by the middle, like, it wasn't as spooky. They started getting into some, like, crazy shit. And it was still good overall. I don't know where I am, though, because I just finished it a day ago. So I need time to digest how I'm feeling about it.
Understandable. I never watched the first one.
Yeah.
And I haven't watched this one yet.
You should definitely watch the first one because I really, really liked it. And I already talked about this because it was my binge like a while ago. But there's this super cool scene where they basically built the entire set of The Haunting of Hill House just to accommodate one scene that they did, because it was like a 26 minute long scene of just one continual shot. Okay. And they're like running through the house and through a funeral home and like all at the same time. And it's very cool. So I got like super into the first season. But then like mostly forgot what it was about. but yeah, I think it's super fun because I don't know, like I like ghosty stuff and you don't get enough ghosty stuff in a ghost movie. Yeah. So if you really draw it out over 8 hours, you got plenty of time to hide some spooky ghosts.
Very true. Like I like the like ghosty paranormal stuff.
Yeah.
But I hate like jump scares that always come in those scary movies.
Yeah.
And like I've just been terrified to watch it because I'm an infant apparently.
I feel like they don't do a lot of jump scares.
Okay.
It's mostly just like, was there a person just standing behind? Not you, sorry. Me talking about the show. Like, was there a person just standing behind her? Or like, did you see that? Did you see like that kind of thing? Like, oh shit, was that a creepy dude behind her? Like, I just scared the absolute shit out of Sarah because I'm an incredible actress.
That was so convincing, honestly. Like, well, also, my fiancé is coming home soon, and so I thought maybe he was trying to, like, play a trick on us and peek in through the window.
I'm so sorry. I did not. I also did not look at you. I looked away into the corner like a fucking creep and just, like, started screaming, basically.
It's fine. It's good.
Oh, 10 out of 10. But, yeah. That's my binge that I've rambled on for far too long about.
Amazing. I want to watch it really bad.
I would definitely suggest it. It's easier to watch during the day, too.
Yes,
so you might have to do that.
So something that we wanted to bring up before we started filming.
Filming.
We're not
fucking filming now.
Before we started talking about the episode.
Yes.
Was that our Halloween episode is coming up.
Oh, yeah.
And we really want you guys to send in your stories so we can do another Halloween episode like we did last year.
Yeah. It would be super fun. We've already gotten a submission, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was for that. I just saw we had a submission. but yeah, freaking submit your creepy stories if they're ghosty stories or true crime stories. Because on Halloween, it's okay if it's not just true crime.
Yeah.
You know?
Honestly, anything like spooky season related we'll accept.
Anything. All right. Should we just get into today's episode?
Let's do it.
All right.
So, we're going to do this episode a little different because normally we talk about the murderer's, like, backstory.
Yeah.
But today we're going to start off with the crime scene.
Yes.
So, on Wednesday, November 15th, 1995, Donna Howell arrived at her job at the Cracker Barrel shortly before 5 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
This Cracker Barrel restaurant is right off of I-75 and County Road 951 in Naples by Alligator Alley. It opened in the summer of 1991, and at the time, there were 231 Cracker Barrels in 26 states, and 19 of them are in Florida.
Amazing, honestly.
Right now, I can't remember the exact number, but they added like 44 more. So now there's like almost 60 in Florida.
Jesus.
And if you didn't know,
yes,
Cracker Barrels are a restaurant that is known for like their old time country decor, home style southern food, and all day breakfasts. And they're usually located right off the interstate. And personally for me, they were like a road trip staple. Every summer when me and my family would drive up to Michigan, we'd stop there at least 3 times.
Yeah. My family also ate there a lot. And I now will never step foot in a fucking Cracker Barrel ever again because I hate it. Fucking hate it. Gives me the shits. Don't like it one bit. I haven't been in a Cracker Barrel, I want to say 5 years. See, because I just, food goes right through me.
When I lived up in Bradenton.
Yeah, you lived like right near it.
It was like a 2-minute drive.
Yeah.
And so we went there for breakfast all the time. And I definitely prefer their breakfast over their other food. Because their other food does go right through me.
The only thing I can get there that's like a safe bet is sausage and biscuits and gravy. That's what I'm trying to say. Jesus. Sausage and biscuits is what I was going to say.
I do like their chicken and dumplings. Like
I haven't had them. They're as an adult
just like
person.
A standard like southern staple.
Yeah.
Anyways, back to the story.
Enough about Cracker Barrel.
Enough about our bowels.
Yeah.
When Donna got to work, she rang the buzzer, expecting the assistant store manager, Dorothy Siddle, to answer the door. After about 15 minutes of ringing the buzzer, pounding on the door with no answer, Donna became kind of worried because she saw Dorothy's car in the parking lot. Mm-hmm. And this around this time was when another employee showed up. And since cell phones weren't common in 1995, Donna had this other employee go to a nearby gas station to call the police.
Yeah.
While this other coworker went to call the police, a third employee showed up who actually had a cell phone, and Donna used their phone to call the restaurant, and there was no answer. So the police were dispatched at 5:16 a.m. and arrived just a few minutes later at 5:21 a.m. They broke into the store through a window in the front door, and a search of the inside of the restaurant brought the police to the kitchen's walk-in freezer.
Yes. On the floor of the walk-in freezer, police found the deceased bodies of 3 employees, Dorothy Siddle, Vicky Smith, and Jason Wiggins. Dorothy Siddle was 38 years old and the store's assistant manager. She was married with 3 kids, and her husband described her as a good woman and a good Christian. She had worked in the restaurant industry for 15 years and had just moved to the area from Palmetto. From Palmetto, Florida, to take the associate manager position at this location of Cracker Barrel. And her goal was to one day run her own location. Vicky Smith was 27 years old and worked as a grill cook there. She was a single mother to a 7-year-old son, and she lived in Copeland, Florida, which was about a 40-minute drive from Naples. And as one could expect, this drive began to be too much for her, and Vicky had to put in her 2 weeks at the restaurant. The week she was murdered was actually supposed to be her last week at the store.
That's so sad.
Yeah. Jason Wiggins was the youngest. He was only 21 years old and worked as an overnight maintenance man, and he usually worked from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. He was around 5'8" tall and had a muscular build, and his brother David also worked there as a janitor and had actually gotten Jason the job there. All 3 victims had their throats slit. Dorothy had her hands bound behind her back with electrical tape, and Vicky and Jason both had electrical tape hanging from their left wrist, and it appeared as though they were able to get their right hands free. The floor and some of the boxes in the freezer were covered with blood, up to 5 feet high. The police described the scene as a slaughterhouse, which if it's like going that much up the walls, that's...
Yeah. Definitely.
Too much force was used in, like, this robbery gone wrong. What I mean?
I feel that's what happens when your throat gets slit. Like, I feel like blood just goes everywhere.
There were bloody footprints that led to the restaurant's office. When they got to the office door, the safe was open. Surrounding the safe was cash and empty plastic containers. So the police immediately thought that this was a robbery gone bad, Since the Cracker Barrel was right off the interstate, the robbers also could have just fled anywhere.
Yeah, like they could have gone to the other coast, to like the Miami area, mm-hmm. or honestly just taken I-75 down to Key West or up to Georgia and the rest of the United States.
Yeah. There were also traces of blood on and around the kitchen sink, meaning that the attackers may have tried to clean up. Another manager, Robert Evans, later determined that $5,374.79 was missing from the safe. However, a green bank bag containing $878 still remained in the safe. When the police searched behind the restaurant, they found scattered bills and coins by the back door, as well as footprints leading away from the restaurant. Under a bush, they found a buck knife, a knife case, and blood-stained gloves. A little bit away, in some tall grass, police found a gun with the hammer in the cocked position. They initially believed that the gun was a Colt 45 automatic, but upon further investigation, they determined that it was actually a Daisy pistol, which is not a real gun, but an air pellet gun or a BB gun. There was also a service road back behind the restaurant, and this is where police believed that a getaway car may have been parked. There was only one set of footprints found at the scene, but the police believed that there had to be more than one attacker, as one person probably wouldn't have been able to overpower all three employees, which is likely true.
Yeah, especially because they're all pretty young.
Yeah, like they're all young, able-bodied people, so mm-hmm. it would be difficult.
So the investigation began immediately. Investigators determined that Jason would have already been inside of the restaurant as he worked overnights. Dorothy arrived to work at 4:30 a.m. and turned off the alarm to the store at 4:33, and Vicky arrived around 10 minutes later. This means that the murder would have happened in the 20-minute span of Vicky arriving and Donna showing up for her shift at 5 a.m.
Which is a very small amount of time
to
do everything.
People? Yeah.
And, like, finish out the robbery mm-hmm. that you were there to do.
So, there was no sign of forced entry into the restaurant. So, the police kind of debated on whether the attacker or attackers slipped in when either Dorothy or Vicky arrived, or if they knew the attackers and just kind of let them in.
Right.
Also, all of the employees still had all of their personal items on them, including their wallets and jewelry, which police thought was strange in a robbery because, you know, they would want to get everything that they could get.
Yeah.
No one saw the attackers flee, so the only evidence that they had at the moment were the things left behind, scattered in the 200 yards of field behind the restaurant, and also the footprints.
Yeah.
And the sheriff's spokesman, Damian Hausman, said this could be a long investigation. The grieving victim's family members and co-workers spoke out to the media. One co-worker named Doreen Pagnato said, "If the killer or killers wanted the money, they should have just taken the money. Why did they have to kill them?"
Good point.
Right? Robert Campbell, who was a cook there for 4.5 years, said, "There's nobody here who's not hurting." He also told the press that Cracker Barrel employees, like many other companies, are taught not to resist robbers at all, to just give them whatever they want and get them out as quickly as possible in order to avoid anyone getting hurt.
Yeah.
Like, that's what we were taught.
Yeah, because it's not worth risking your life for a job that pays you minimum wage.
Exactly. Sally Wiggins, who is Jason's mother, talked about her son's love of video games, country and reggae music, and his love of his 1973 Ford pickup truck, and she said, "It's just like a bad dream." His brother David also said that he believed that malice motivated the killer because neither him or Vicky would have confronted or tried to fight off of a robber, resulting in the attack. They would have complied.
Mm-hmm. And around this time, restaurants actually became a more popular place to rob than gas stations or convenience stores, because convenience stores recently enacted laws that require increased security, including additional employees working at night, security cameras, and special safes that only allowed a certain amount of cash to be obtained, where restaurants did not have these laws. This severity of crime was also not common at the time in Collier County. The last time a triple homicide happened in the county was over 10 years prior and was drug-related. Collier County Sheriff Chief Chris Roberts said, "At that time, it was one of the most heinous crimes in Collier County. You just didn't see that sort of thing in Naples, Florida back then, no more than you see it today. We were just coming down from some of the stuff in the 70s and 80s where we had the cocaine cowboys and square grouper. We had murders related to those, but something like what happened at Cracker Barrel wasn't common at all." In an interview in 2018, Charles Roberts said, "In 95, Collier was a lot different than it was today. It was a lot smaller of an area, for one. We were just coming off the heyday of being the cocaine and marijuana importation capital of the country. We were just starting the transition into what Collier County has become today, which is a very safe retirement/vacation destination, and so far, for that type of crime to happen here, not tied to drugs or anything of that nature, was somewhat unusual."
Which is interesting. I did not know that Naples, Florida was like the cocaine and marijuana capital of the world or the nation.
Me either. I wouldn't, yeah.
Like, that's, I feel like it'd be Miami, you know?
Yeah, for sure. It is very near Miami, so maybe like it's being transported through there. Who knows? So, in order to collect evidence and wait for the medical examiner to show up, the bodies were not removed from the freezer until around 6:30 p.m. that evening. And this meant that the bodies were too frozen to conduct autopsies on the victims right away.
Yeah, because that's over 12 hours in a freezer.
Yeah, but at least it, like, slows down the process of anything that was happening.
Yeah,
so,
like decomp.
Yeah.
So, the next day, Manfred Borges, who was the associate medical examiner for Collier County, performed the autopsies on all three bodies. The manner of death for all three victims was homicide caused by sharp force injuries to the neck. Dorothy's throat was cut using at least three passes with a knife. Her carotid artery, vagus nerve, jugular, and spinal cord were cut all the way down to the vertebrae, almost decapitating her. The ME determined that she would have been paralyzed and died very quickly after her spinal cord was cut. Like Dorothy, Vicky's carotid artery, vagus nerve, and jugular were cut to the vertebrae, but her spinal cord was not cut. Only one pass from the knife was found on Vicky, and she would have died fairly quickly from blood loss. Jason suffered at least two wounds from a strong knife. The upper wound was a stab that went into the jugular vein, and the lower injury was a cut across the voice box, and it would have taken anywhere from 10 seconds to 2 minutes for Jason to die from loss of blood.
That's, like, doesn't seem like a very long time, 2 minutes, but just, like, think of that poor boy if he was there for 20 minutes. Like, that's awful.
All three victims were killed with a weapon that was identical to the buck knife found outside of the restaurant. Like, it had to be strong blade, like, no ridges, stuff like that. There was blood residue found on the knife that they found and the knife sheath, but it was too small of an amount to be able to conduct forensic evidence to see who the blood belonged to, because obviously in the 90s, it wasn't where it is today.
Yeah.
Cracker Barrel headquarters opened up all personnel files to investigators in case the crime was committed by a past or present employee. And a Cracker Barrel spokesperson said that the store was going to remain closed for as long as investigators needed, but the workers were still going to get paid.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, I feel honestly, like a lot of places wouldn't do that.
Yeah. When interviewing current employees, two former workers came up a lot in conversation. and police decided that they should focus on these two men first. Brandy Bain Jennings had worked at Jennings. I literally can't talk today.
It was very southern.
Brandy Bain Jennings had worked as a grill cook for about 11 months, and Charles Jason Graves, who was a dishwasher. Brandy and Charles were friends and had known each other for about 3 years, and they also rented a place together. So they were, like, pretty close.
Yeah.
Chief Charles Roberts said, "It was one of those things like peeling an onion. Every layer we peeled back made us feel more certain Jennings and Graves were the folks we should be focused on." Okay, Shrek.
Right?
Like, talking about your investigation like it's an onion. Both of these men quit their job at the Cracker Barrel just 2 months before the murders. Brandy quit because he wanted to move up in the business and become a server. However, management would not train him because he was known to have a bad temper and a bad attitude, and you have to be a sweet little southern lady in order to be a server at goddamn Cracker Barrel.
Right?
Just kidding. You can also be a sweet southern man. I'm just kidding. Actually, I feel like the people at Cracker Barrel are just like, look at my fucking flare and get out of my face. Like, that's what I remember about Cracker Barrel, because they still have flare on their aprons, right?
I don't know what flare is.
Sarah, did you ever watch the movie Waiting or ever go to a Bennigan's?
Yes.
They used to, like, in the early 2000s, late 90s, like, wear the pins all over their vest, and they would, like, get pins for things that they did. I'm, like, devolving into a weird southern accent today. Like, I think that just the sheer
thought of Cracker Barrel
is making my southern accent come out.
So they don't do that anymore, but their aprons have stars on them for how many years they've been there.
Mm-hmm. I remember the stars.
And, like, is embroidered, but they don't have a bunch of pins and stuff.
I thought they did. Maybe they didn't.
But honestly, like, the nicest servers I've ever encountered have come from Cracker Barrel, so, like, you can't have a bad attitude and be a server.
That's true. That's true. All right. So, Brandy also had a previous record of an armed robbery charge that he had just finished serving probation for. So, the two were unable to find steady work after quitting, and was even behind on his truck and rent payments. Charles quit shortly after Brandy did, because Brandy was always his ride to work, and he couldn't find anyone else to take him there, pretty simply. It was well known in the restaurant that Brandy and Charles, especially Brandy, it's mostly Brandy, did not like the assistant manager, Dorothy Siddle. Dorothy was responsible for doing the evaluations on the grill cooks, and Brandy believed that she was the reason that he could not be moved to be a server. He was overheard multiple times by other employees about Dorothy saying, "I can't stand that bitch. I hate her. I even hate the sound of her voice." So Charles Jason Graves was an 18-year-old, and he went by his middle name, Jason. He was about 5'10", tall and skinny, and he had moved to the Naples area about 5 years earlier. He was known to be friendly and helpful to neighbors and friends, but some people found him kind of strange because he enjoyed talking about fights, guns, and crime. He got in trouble at school often and dropped out of high school. And Brandy Bain Jennings was 26 years old. He was described by his mother as a gentle giant. He is about 6'5 and weighed 275 pounds. He was raised by a single mother and never met his father. As a kid, him and his mother moved all around the United States and settled in Fort Myers when he was 14. He dropped out of high school when he was 17 to take care of his mother when she became too sick to work. And his friends described him as a nice guy who was good with children and seemed like a big brother to everyone.
So, after hearing about all of these things that Jennings and Charles have said and that they didn't like Dorothy Siddle, police wanted to get in contact with Brandy and Charles, but they couldn't locate them. So they put a bolo out on Brandy's white Ford pickup truck with the license plate number, and they put this bolo out across the United States. It was later determined that the two spent the next 2 days at a nudie bar in Fort Myers called Flirts, And a dancer named Danielle remembered seeing them and recalled that they were having a good time together. They didn't seem weird, stuff mm-hmm. like that. And over the course of those 2 days, the pair spent around $1,000 at the bar.
Which is kind of suspicious when you weren't previously able to make your rent payments. But, right? You know, Teva.
Yeah. She also remembered that Charles was complaining about his knee and said that he was in a bike accident. But, like, when a dancer accidentally hit his knee, he, like, squirmed around and complained.
Interesting.
So, on December 8th, which was about 3 weeks after the murders, police officer Gordon McGee of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department was on a routine patrol when he pulled up behind a white Ford pickup truck with Florida plates while at a red light. And McGee just decided to run the plates while at the light, like police officers will randomly do. And he got a hit on the plates through the nationwide bolo put out by the Collier County Sheriff's Office. The computer hit and said that the occupants in the vehicle were possibly armed and dangerous, so McGee followed the truck while he requested backup. When backup arrived, McGee turned on his lights and sirens and pulled the truck over, which the truck did come to a stop on the side of the road. As this was technically a high-risk felony car stop, McGee just shouted instructions to the men inside of the vehicle before just, like, going up to the window. There was some hesitation, and then the men in the car did not follow the commands and suddenly just drove off. So, the officers gave chase onto the highway and noted that the truck was being driven erratically with speeds reaching up to 95 miles an hour. After a 20-mile high-speed chase, the truck eventually slowed down to a stop on the side of the road. I'm personally assuming that they were, like, running out of gas or something and were like, oh, well, I guess it's over. This time, the men obeyed the officer's commands and were apprehended. Brandy Jennings was driving the truck and Charles Graves was in the passenger seat. And the police held them on whatever they could so they could contact the Collier County Police. And the men were held on counts of evading police, driving on a suspended license, and possession of a controlled substance.
When word got back to Collier County that the two men had been arrested, Detectives Andy Rose and Jay Crenshaw were actually driving to North Florida to interview Charles's family. They were around Tampa when they got the call and immediately turned around, drove to the Southwest Florida International Airport in Fort Myers, and hopped a flight to Las Vegas. They only had one change of clothes with them, so they're just on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
Chief Investigator for the State Attorney's Office, Ralph Cunningham, also got on a flight and met the detectives in Las Vegas. At first, Brandy did not want to talk to the detectives, but changed his mind the next morning, saying that he had talked to his mother on the phone, and she told him to cooperate and tell the truth about what happened.
Just like a little thing, the only court documents and interviews that I could find were from Brandy Jennings. I couldn't find the actual documents from Charles Graves.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this is from Brandy's point of view, what he told in his interview.
Okay. In a four-hour interview, Brandy admitted that he and Charles were hurting for cash, and they thought that the restaurant would be easy to rob. They made a plan to wear masks and rush one of the managers when they were leaving to go to the bank with a deposit. In this statement, he blamed Charles for the murders. They apparently attempted to do this plan, driving to the Cracker Barrel 2 times, but chickened out both times. 2 days before the robbery, Charles went to Walmart and bought the air pellet gun. He said that he wanted to buy a .22, but Walmart had a policy about selling guns to people under the age of 21. So he bought the air gun, thinking that it looked real enough, and said that if they had a gun, they wouldn't be able to, like, have to manhandle or hurt anyone.
So, on the day of the murder, the two took Brandy's truck to the Cracker Barrel and arrived there at 3:30 a.m. They noticed Jason Wiggins' truck in the parking lot and waited. They watched Dorothy Siddle arrive. And then, when Vicki Smith arrived shortly after, the men got out of the truck and approached Vicki, saying that their truck was broken down and asked if she could call a tow truck for them. They then ask if they could wait inside the restaurant for the tow truck, but Vicky said no, as it was against company policy. But when she opened the door, Charles rushed her and the two men got inside. Brandy said that Charles was acting real stressed out, scared, and real hyper, and he had never seen Charles act that way. Brandy bound Vicky and Jason's hands together with electrical tape and brought them to the cooler, while Charles took Dorothy to the office to open the safe. He said that he eventually used the buck knife that he was carrying to cut the electrical tape off of Jason. Charles then brought Vicky back to be with the others and watched over them while Brandy went to the office to get money, and he put some in a trash bag and then stuffed some in his pants. Charles joined him after a few minutes, and Brandy said at this point he didn't notice any blood on Charles' clothes. While Charles was still in the office, like, ravaging the safe, Brandy went back to the kitchen to check on the victims, and he said that he did this because he wanted to make sure that Charles didn't lock the freezer door so that way they could get out and live and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So this is when he opened the freezer door and saw the three on the ground in pools of blood. Brandy said that he freaked out and slipped in blood that belonged to Vicky, and then he told Charles that they just had to get out of there. They ran out the back door into the truck, with money flying out of their pants the whole time. When they left, they took off their clothes, bundled them up with rocks, and threw them into a canal in North Cape Canaveral. That's not Cape Canaveral. In North Cape Coral, along with a homemade knife that Charles had been carrying.
So, like, that's good and all, and maybe that's totally how it went down. But he says that Jason was specifically untied,
mm-hmm.
and then, like, three people were brutally murdered with one of the men,
yeah,
like, being untied. Just a very poorly put together story.
It is. It's like, I mean, it could have maybe happened.
Yeah, but because, it's unlikely.
Because, yeah. Like, I mean, he had something that looked like a gun, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very unlikely that he didn't help kill anybody.
Right.
So, the items that the boys had, the knife and everything, were eventually recovered from the canal. And... I'm trying... Since when we talk... It's, like, hard for listeners to remember sometimes what we're talking about. So I was trying to do, like, a transition. It just didn't work. Blah, blah, blah. So these items were eventually recovered from the canal and consisted of gloves, clothes, shoes, socks, a homemade knife, packaging from a pellet air gun, a money bag marked Cracker Barrel, money bands, a clear garbage bag, and rocks, which were weighing down the bundle of evidence. An expert testified that the bloody footprints in and around the Cracker Barrel matched the prints on the shoes that belonged to Jennings, which were pulled out of the canal. The homemade knife found in the canal was examined, and it was determined that it was too flimsy and was squared off at the ends and would not have been able to make the wounds inflicted on the victims. And that they had to have come from the buck knife that Brandy said that he was carrying. Brandy said that the two stayed in hotels around the Fort Myers area for the next few days, going to the nude bar and a shooting range where Charles successfully bought a gun this time. The two then planned to go to Oregon, where Brandy was originally from, and set out on their road trip, sleeping in the truck at rest stops. Brandy said that the money was starting to run out, and he was afraid that Charles would kill him once the money was gone. When the two got pulled over in Las Vegas, Brandy said that he took off and started driving when he saw there were so many guns pointed at him.
So, after multiple interviews with Brandy, as well as interviews with Charles, there seemed to be some inconsistencies with Brandy's story. Both men admitted to doing the robbery, but blamed each other for the murders.
Of course.
After being confronted by the police about these inconsistencies, Brandy said in a taped interview, quote, "I think I could have been the killer. In my mind, I think I may have killed them, but in my heart, I don't think I could have." And the next day, not on a taped interview, he made a very similar statement saying, "In my mind, I think I'm the killer, but my heart tells me I couldn't have killed these people." So he's straight up saying that he's the killer.
Yeah, he's like, "I really didn't want to be the killer, but it looks like I am."
So obviously they both pled not guilty to the murders. And during the trial, one of Brandy's friends, Angela Chaney, testified that she was with Brandy and some other friends one night and the topic of money came up. Brandy said that if he ever needed money, he could always just rob someplace or somebody. And also, this was before the murders happened. Angela replied, "That's stupid. You could get caught." To which Brandy said, "Not if you don't leave any witnesses," while making like a cutting motion around his neck with his finger.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little damning, since, you know, these people's throats were slit just like that. So during the trial, Brandy wanted his statements that he made to police in Las Vegas to be thrown out because he said that he asked for a lawyer. But the police continued to question him afterwards. But in his taped interview, he was read his Miranda rights and then just continued to talk anyways. So his desire to have his statements thrown out was denied.
Yeah.
Because of how big the case was at the time and the extensive media coverage in Collier County, Brandy asked for a change of venue for the trial, and this was granted, and the trial happened in Pinellas County. Brandy and Charles were tried separately, but something that's, like, kind of interesting is that the prosecution was able to use all of the evidence in both trials. Like, they weren't just doing, like, Jennings shoes and whatever for Jennings, and so they were able to use everything. In Charles's trial, the death penalty was waived in order to give the prosecution more time to prepare. So no matter what the outcome was, the death penalty was never on the table for Charles. He ended up being convicted of 3 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of robbery. He was sentenced to 3 sentences of life in prison for the murders plus 15 years for the robbery. And Brandy was tried next. He was also found guilty on the 3 counts of first-degree murder and the 1 count of robbery. And on December 12, 1996, he was given the sentence of death for the 3 murders, plus 15 years for the robbery. The judge, who presided in both trials, concluded in his own mind that Brandy was indeed the murderer. And this was also the case that the prosecution used in both trials. Like, in Brandy's trial, they were like, yeah, he's the murderer, but Charles helped.
Yeah. That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Both men applied for appeals right after the trial, which were denied. Brandy filed for an appeal many times after the murder, but they were all denied. And his most recent attempt for an appeal was in January 2018, where he tried to have his death penalty thrown out due to change in the statuses of the death penalty in the state of Florida, which a lot of people did this. So many people tried to do this with their death penalty cases in Florida. And we've actually kind of talked about this before in one of our very early episodes. You should go back and listen to it. But this change was what happened in the Carly Brucia case with her killer, Joseph P. Smith, where before, only a majority of the jury had to agree on the death penalty in order to enact it, and the change was that in order to sentence someone to death, the vote had to be unanimous. This appeal for Brandy was denied, and he is still currently on death row. Brandy Jennings has not had a visitor in jail since 2012, when a pen pal came to visit him. Charles Grave is regularly visited by his girlfriend, mother, and other relatives. Was this girlfriend his girlfriend? You probably don't know this, but before or after?
I do not know.
Dang it.
I know. I thought about that too.
Yeah. In 2002, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected a request from Charles' attorney to hear a challenge to his 1996 conviction. His lawyer later said, "Graves' only change now is that Jennings will absolve Graves of the murders before the sovereign state of Florida fries Jennings." What a sentence.
Right?
Holy shit. One of the jurors from Brandy's trial, Felicia Wojcik, says that she still thinks about the case to this day and often checks his appeal status on the computer. It's something I'm never going to forget as long as I live. I still have nightmares about the brutality of the killings and the senselessness of it. I'll never forget the photographs, and I'll never forget the victims. The fact that he's still living bothers me a great deal. The husband of Dorothy Siddle, Clifford, says that he is frustrated that the execution date has still not been set for Brandy. He admitted he did it, but 20 years later, you're still feeding him. That's wrong. There's just not going to be any peace or rest till he's gone. Vicky Smith's father, Malcolm Smith, said, I couldn't be there for Vicky during her last minutes of life, so I want to be there to see his last minutes. I don't know at this point what I will be thinking or feeling as I watch him die, but I'm just hoping I'll stay alive long enough to see it. And again, there has still not been an execution date set for Jennings, and to this day, he actually still denies that he took part in the murders.
Yeah, he still says that it was all Charles.
Yeah.
So, like, my main question and, like, the thing that I was racking my brain about this whole time is, like, was this just supposed to be a robbery that actually went wrong and someone tried to fight back or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Or did they do it for a personal reason and killed them out of jealousy or malice? Or did they kill them to keep their identity hidden? Or, like, you know, there's so many possibilities that, like, no one knows because they're all just blaming each other.
Yeah, that's, like, the one thing I think that really bothers me about true crime is, like, the only people who know what happened are the people who were in the room, and you can't trust the person who survived being in the room.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's crazy. I feel like the boys had two different intentions and were lying to each other about their intentions.
Yeah.
I think one had a personal vendetta, and I think the other literally just wanted money.
Exactly.
You know, like, I think that it was just, like, lying to each other to get what they needed to, like, go and commit that murder.
Yeah, because I, like, read at one point when they were, like, confronting Brandy with the inconsistencies, they were like, well, according to the ME, like, the buck knife was what was used to slit their throats. And he was like, well, I guess I wasn't carrying it the whole time. Maybe I put it down or something.
Yeah.
And he was like, I don't remember slipping in the blood, but then there was blood all over my clothes, so I must have slipped in it. Like,
yeah.
And shit like that.
Maybe he actually did black out and, like, doesn't remember it. But I feel like that's pretty rare from what I've heard, like, in true crime actually happening. Like, you black out to a certain extent, I'm sure, if you're committing a violent act like that. But not to the extent that you don't know if you were holding the weapon and stuff like that. Yeah, that case is an interesting one because, I mean, it's not like the yogurt shop murders in the way that it's not, like, it hasn't been found. But I'm sure there are so many murders like this where people were just, like, trying to do their frickin' job and random person just came in and ended it for no reason. Like,
oh, yeah, definitely.
It's terrible.
When I was looking this up, I found that there is another Cracker Barrel murder. But it was, like, this dad and his family were eating there, and the dad just killed his whole family while they were eating at Cracker Barrel.
What?
Yeah. It was, like, in Ohio.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
That's insane. Well, I'm looking into that case afterwards.
Right?
Because when I looked up, because, you know, the Google search is so specific, when I looked up, like, the Cracker Barrel murders, the first, I would say, five or six is, like, we're coming up on the almost 30-year anniversary of it. So, like, that's all I saw. But first off, don't talk about almost being 30 because I'm 6 months younger than the fucking Cracker Barrel murders. So, I mean, yeah, 6 months older.
Yeah.
Right?
You were born six months before the murders. I was born a year before they happened.
Which is probably why we did not know about them, truthfully.
That is true.
Because we were little babies. But we hope that you guys enjoyed this week's episode, a bit of a different one that you probably haven't heard before.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Please make sure, like Sarah said at the beginning of the episode, that you go on to crimebinge.com and submit your listener stories for spooky season.
Right? And honestly, if you're too lazy to do that, we will kindly accept them into, like, our Instagram DMs.
Yeah, for now.
Yeah, we will prefer them in the submission, but we'll take it.
We can look through our DMs. Sarah will do that because I don't know how to do all of that.
Please check us out on social media in order to reach our DMs. And we are at Crime Binge on Twitter and Crime Binge Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. And like she said, we have the website, which is crimebinge.com. And also, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts because it does great things for us.
And keep on binging. Bye.
See ya.